Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
Brought to you by Black Knight, it's the Technology.ie podcast, episode 51, for November 22nd, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Dis Mariva Kiskith Falter Evishtak, hello and welcome to Technology.ie. I'm Conor Muinichon and he's Michaela Nealon. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Con.
How are you?
Not too bad. A bit tired.
Back in Ireland after your. Describe your itinerary again for us, please.
It was a little bit convoluted. I did Dublin, Paris, Paris, Belgrade, Belgrade, Brussels, Brussels back to Charles de Gaulle by train, and then Charles de Gaulle back to Dublin.
Fantastic. Over how many days?
That was between Thursday and Tuesday.
Very nice. Tell me, you were at Webfest, the closing event in Belgrade. You said not a lot to report. It was all in Serbian.
Well, yeah. It was kind of struck me as I was heading out to it. I suddenly went, oh my God, this is only going to be in Serbian. This is going to be an interesting experience.
How was it? How was it?
It was good. I mean, it was one of these kind of award ceremonies more than anything else. Held in a theatre in the centre of Belgrade. And, you know, a lot of the web developer-y types, the startups and all that from Serbia, Croatia, Montenegro, possibly other countries in the area. And, you know, the Webfest event itself had been held back in September in Budva, Montenegro, and this was the actual awards thing that kind of ran alongside it. Couldn't understand a word they were saying.
it's unusual to imagine you sidelined or sidetracked at an event like that, Michaela, or having difficulty communicating. I find that difficult to imagine. You went on to Brussels then, no difficulties there. Back in Ireland, and we're going to post some of the pictures as well. We'll post links to your Flickr links to your Flickr pages covering that trip in Belgrade and Brussels, November 2012, there on the website at technology.ie as well. We're also going to link to Silicon Republic with a story this week in relation to Irish Rail Wi-Fi. They've hit 1 million sessions since it was launched and rolled out on Irish Rail trains. It's not fully rolled out yet, though, Michaela, is it?
As far as I can gather, no. I mean, it's on a lot of the bigger routes.
It's on Dublin to Cork, anyway. I don't know if it's on the Limerick trains or not. I haven't gone in a while. Mind you, I'm taking a trip next week and I'll be looking forward to trying it out and seeing what it's like. Have you used it yet?
I have, yeah. I've used it from Carlow to Dublin and Dublin to Carlow.
How have you found it?
That's the Dublin-Waterford line. How can I put this? It's functional. The latency and everything else can be pretty painful,
right?
But it is functional. I mean, you know, you can use it for, I suppose, checking email and, you know, doing kind of basic stuff. But to be perfectly honest, you'd probably be better off on 3G at times because, I mean, their system, I don't know. I mean, there's some details in the Silicon Republic report about
it. There is, yeah. It says, for example, Facebook and Twitter and email are allowed. Music or video sites are blocked to avoid any one person hogging the available bandwidth. It looks like, you know, contention really is the issue and the number of users and, you know, that it is... It depends how many 3G connections they're using for this, Michele. I see the article also points out that it's ready for 4G and LTE, so once that's launched, as they said in the article, it'll be ready to go. That's going to make a huge difference as well, of course.
Well, I mean, the faster, if you were able to get a good, solid, stable connection on those trains with, you know, decent latency, it'd be absolutely fantastic. I mean, the thing is, you know, taking the train up to Dublin, you know, you can work all the way up. It's from Carlow to Dublin's only about an hour.
Yeah.
You know, that's an hour you can spend doing stuff instead of being stuck in traffic or whatever.
That's what works for me, and it's what has worked in the past. And then again, there have been, at least when I was taking the train regularly, there were blind spots and black spots, say, between Thurles and Limerick Junction, for example, not very good for most of that part of it, and indeed between Limerick Junction and Limerick City, not good either. But, you know, And again, if you know, a lot of us, Michaela, are working with we're working in the cloud, or we're working with web email, web mail, or something similar to that. And, you know, that's good enough for us. We don't need all that much connectivity, but it does make it very productive if you can dash off 3 or 4 or 5 emails and reply to a few things and get things moving on a 1 hour journey. In your case, 2.5 hour journey. In my case, coming from Ennis and Limerick. So it's hopefully something, as I say, that I'm looking forward to trying out next week. What else have we got to discuss this week? Parkia, you've blogged this on technology.ie. This is a cool app.
Yeah, this is something which, it's Jason Rowe who's behind us.
I know Jason, yeah.
I mean, everybody knows Jason.
Yeah.
The idea, I mean, he's explained it to me, and it kind of covers a little bit there in the blog post. The idea is that it's a mobile app. If you're trying to find parking, it'll tell you where the nearest car parks are. But the other thing as well is it helps you to actually pay for your parking.
Okay.
Now, from what I can gather, now I don't park often in the centre of Dublin, so really, I'm just kind of going on kind of, you know, what people are telling me. there's several providers offering parking in Dublin, so you can end up where you have to pay different ones depending on where you park and all this kind of thing. So if they can make that a little bit simpler so that they act as a kind of a clearinghouse or whatever for all the parking, plus helping people to find spaces, I can see that being of use to people. So they've launched a private beta. I blogged about it there earlier this evening, and you know the links are there, so if you want to sign up.
That's cool. And it'll send you a text as well when your parking is about to expire, which is clever. You've also blogged about the ultimate lazy person's bed. I like this one.
That cracked me up. Oh, that cracked me up. I mean, this is laziness. Like, I can be lazy at the best of times.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of geeks can be. You know, we find ways to automate things. We buy and we get gadgets to make our lives simpler or better or both. This, however, is laziness taken to, I don't know, the nth degree. It's a bed.
Yeah.
It's a special bed. This is not something you can add on to an existing bed. It's a special bed that you buy. And not only is the bed itself special, but the bedding you use with it is custom. And what happens is that when you get out of the bed, you don't have to worry about making it because within like 30 seconds after the last person has vacated the bed, it will automatically make itself.
Yeah. You know something, I'm not sure that how much, you know, I'm not sure this is a winner, Michaela, to be honest with you. It takes less than a minute to make a bed on a good day, and I'm not sure there'll be quite the demand for this. It reminds me of, you know, you have to buy the custom bed, your special bed, the special bed covers, the whole lot. I wonder if it's worth the trouble. But then again, somebody would probably... For the right customer, I suppose it is. That's just the question.
Tom, I mean, I was looking at it and I was kind of thinking to myself, you know, okay, would I use this? And to be perfectly honest, almost. I mean, it's I'm not quite there, but not far off it.
How much is it?
I don't know. No. I mean, this is the thing. I couldn't work that out. I mean, it seems to be that the website is advertising it. There's videos. There's FAQs. The site's available in English, Spanish, and Euskera because they're a Basque company. But I couldn't find any information on the price. I mean, it's one of those things. It looks like they're launching it now, or they're about to launch it. But you know, it looks pretty cool. I can see some people might go for it. I don't know. I mean. Yeah. I just thought it was quirky.
This next one is quirky as well, Michele, but possibly more useful. Virtual tape measure could find you the perfect jeans with just a webcam. It's the headline from Engadget, and you brought it to my attention this evening. Explain this to me.
Well, okay, Tom. Selling clothes online, if you remember during the dot-com boom, there were a couple of big websites where people poured millions of dollars into building these websites because they thought that selling clothes online was going to be an overnight success. And it wasn't. it fell flat on its face. I mean, sure, today people are buying clothes, shoes, and things like that online. But the problem everybody has is that unless you know your exact size, you either won't be able to buy the stuff, or you're going to end up with stuff that doesn't fit you particularly well.
This is the thing about online buying, is that, you know, when you buy clothes, you want to go to the changing room. You want to try it on.
Which, well, if you're a very standard size, maybe that isn't an issue. I mean, if you know that, you know, your waist is, you know, a 36-inch waist, whatever, I don't know, whatever size shoes
you
have.
I think it nearly is. No matter, you know yourself, Michele. I mean, the sizes vary. What is, say, size 10 on one manufacturer, one retailer is totally different from somebody else.
This is it. So yeah. what this idea here is that, now this is one of these kind of, you know, experimental, it's not ready for prime time yet. The idea would be that using the webcam on your computer, it would be able to kind of scan you when you're standing there in your underclothes, and you give it a couple of measurements, like your height, so it kind of has some idea what the hell it's dealing with, and it'll be able to give you a much more accurate sizing, so you'd be able to buy clothes and shoes and things that fit you properly.
So is this an app? Is this
This is purely experimental at the moment.
Okay, right. But the idea is you take a picture in your underwear, and you put in your height, and then it obviously works out from that what your potential size is.
I mean, it's not available yet. I mean, they're hoping to launch it within the next 2 years. But I just thought to myself, you know, this solves a problem. I mean, this is one of these things. It is a problem. You know, lots of websites are trying to come up with ways of solving it. Nobody's really come up with a solution as yet.
It's clever, actually, because this could, it's the kind of thing that could become a standard and ultimately perhaps replace the whole notion of knowing what your size is and buying clothes by the size entirely. Because simply, you know, if your size, if there is, for example, some bit of XML or some bit of data, if there's a format for for your size, if you have, let's say, a little file that contains your size information, be that in the cloud or be that in your app or whatever, or be that you know, in a cookie or something that you have on your own machine, then obviously you can visit websites online and only see clothes that fit you, or, you know, only see clothes which have your size in stock. It's very interesting, Michele. This could get legs and arms and indeed shoulders and lapels and all kinds of things as well. All right, no, bad joke. Let's move on. Instagram launches badges for business users. Is this, you've blogged on technology.ie this week, Michele. Is this is this in response to the Pinterest threat?
Not really, no. I don't think the two go hand in hand at all. I mean, see, Pinterest started as a website
yeah.
with a mobile app.
Yeah.
Instagram started as a mobile app. You could view individual photos online. Then they launched the profiles thing a few weeks back so that you could go to Instagram.com/username. And see, you know, people's photos and kind of interact with them a little bit. What they're obviously trying to do here is make it more kind of brand friendly. And what the other thing as well is that, you know, they launched that probably yesterday or something. Sorry, one second. And now what was announced in the last 24, 48 hours is that Facebook are changing their usage policy for their data. So they're going to be sharing the data that they collect across all of their properties, all of their companies, because, you know, Facebook's buying things up. So what some people are saying is that this could be a way for them to start monetizing things, you know, kind of driving more traffic, monetizing it, taking it onto the web, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. It's an interesting move by them.
Does this badge do anything? It links, I presume. So one of the things it does, I presume, is track you, Michele, in the sense that if, for example, is it similar to, say, to the like button? Is it if you're logged into to Instagram, for example, will this detect that you've visited a site that has this badge, for example?
I honestly don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I think that, you know, this they've only rolled this stuff out in the last 24 or 48 hours.
This is definitely worth keeping an eye on, I think. I'm kind of curious about it, and I'm curious about how this integrates in with Facebook.
Well, it doesn't at the moment, but the point being that Facebook have changed the policy on the data usage, the data sharing. So the thing is, by doing that, they're opening themselves up, opening up other possibilities of maybe, let's say, you know, gathering information about Facebook users on other properties that Facebook controls, or and going back, you know, sending them data in both directions. Honestly, I don't know. I just saw a couple of articles about it. I thought it was kind of interesting anyway.
It kind of is, and definitely I think we're going to hear more about that as well. What's next? iTunes, Michele, there's a new version of iTunes launched, which is kind of overdue, really, isn't it?
Well, it hasn't launched yet. It's about to launch.
Okay.
You see, the thing is this. With Apple rolling out more and more devices with the Retina displays, a lot of the software, and actually a lot of the web as well, looks fairly, well, how can I put this genteelly? It doesn't look that good.
Right. Yeah.
Because once you start moving to higher resolutions, you know, you need content that is designed to be seen at a higher resolution. Mm. The new iTunes, according to the article on T3.com, is a much more visual experience. So I'm looking here at iTunes on my Mac. And, you know, sure, there's plenty of icons and everything else, but it wouldn't be as rich a visual experience as it could be. So the new version is supposedly much richer. They've got a few screenshots and everything else. You see, it's all shiny icons. And
I'm not sure it's just the visuals either, Michele. I'm not sure that iTunes has been a rich experience for a while, to be honest with you. And maybe I'm being a bit harsh in it. Is iTunes important to you?
Well, yes and no. As an Apple user, you kind of spend a lot of your time popping in and out of both iTunes and the App Store. Between one thing and another, they're kind of hubs, as it were, for accessing applications, content, and everything else. I mean, as on the Apple TV, I'm obviously popping into the iTunes interface quite a bit, but that's, you know, the TV version of it, not the desktop or mobile version. But you know, when it comes to listening to music, I haven't been using iTunes as much of late. I've been using Spotify more and more over the last few months.
And indeed I have over the last week, Michele, as well, and since we talked about it last week. And I was interested, you know, I'm a total Spotify newbie, and my questions to you last week, I think, reflected that. And you said, go off, try it. Go for the premium deluxe, or whatever they call it, edition, the 30-day free trial that is on. I've done all that, Michele. As I explained last week, if it's not mobile, if it's not on an app, it's of no value to me, because I don't listen to music at a PC. I work at the PC, and as soon as I'm finished work, I try and get as far away as I can from the computer. So, but I've actually found, even at work last week, you know, I had Spotify running, you know, when I was able to sort of have a bit of music going, enjoyed that, and got the app going. Had a bit of difficulty getting the Android app going. It told me initially that it wasn't on the network. Couldn't connect to a network when it clearly was connected to the office Wi-Fi. But when it got going and kind of synced up, I'm very impressed, Michele. And my first thought, really, once I sort of sat back and evaluated after a few minutes, was, what do I need iTunes for?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, if you're not using iTunes to buy content and everything else, then yeah, why would you need it?
And I was using that, and you know, going back, certainly going back 3 or 4 years, there was a time when I was when I built up quite a digital music collection using iTunes. But now the whole thing is available to me there on Spotify, and you know, it's interesting.
It is that it isn't. I mean, this is the thing you'll discover the more you use it. You'll discover that for some artists, not everything that you'd expect to be there is there. But the other thing about Spotify, Connor, something we haven't really touched on, is that a lot of devices, like physical devices, support Spotify. So you, if you go off and you buy yourself, you know, a new AV receiver, it could actually have Spotify support built in.
Okay. Yeah, I think you mentioned that last week, actually.
So, you know, you could do is like, I mean, if I was to upgrade my my amp downstairs, I'd probably go for one which had Spotify built in. I mean, I wouldn't be going off and buying one that didn't have it. But, you know, that's me. Yeah.
No, it's definitely interesting, and I will be interested to see if this new iTunes launch is more than just a pretty face and high resolution, Michele, because I don't know, it's hard to, I don't mean to sound ungrateful for the revolution that is iTunes and music on demand, but I'd be very interested to kind of see maybe, I think it's overdue an overhaul, and what they might do next with it might be interesting to see. Next story, oatmeal are back in the courts again, Michele, is that right?
Yeah, this one took me by surprise. I mean, it's like, that came from nowhere.
This is The Oatmeal, the comic site.
I mean, this is our friend of The Oatmeal, the guy who likes to give the finger to lawyers and who also managed to raise all the money to buy the property for the museum. And, you know, he's an interesting character. I mean, this is one of these ones, and I'd love to see a bit more, get a bit more information on it. I just came across one article. The Oatmeal has been going as a webcomic, it's been around for years. He's been selling prints and various other things for quite some time. And recently he announced that he was going to do a series of cards in association with some other company. But it appears that there's an existing greeting cards company who are called Oatmeal Studios, and they're more than a little upset about the entire thing, saying that the Oatmeal is infringing on their rights and that he needs to stop.
Well, this is the old thing. I mean, you know, nobody confuses Apple computers with a fruit company, for example, and as long as you can have the same trademark, isn't that the principle? You can have the same trademark, or you can have the same name or a similar sounding name to another company, and as long as you're not in the same business, then, you know, it's not considered, you know, that it would confuse people. But and that's the basis of this complaint, really, and of this case, isn't it? That the suit claims, I'm quoting from the article here in CNET, the suit claims that Inman's The Oatmeal, that's the Oatmeal comic, sounds confusingly similar to Oatmeal Studios' trademark, Oatmeal Studios being the greeting card company, in a way that is likely to cause confusion, mistake, or is likely to deceive customers. Do you think that's reasonable, Michele? He's got a point, I suppose.
I mean, I'd need to see more details to really understand how valid the complaint is, but at an initial viewing, yeah, you can see that does have, it could have legs.
Yeah. It's not necessarily like the other case, or not so much case, but the other legal saga they were recently involved in was really a case of trolling, I think you could say, in many ways. But this is different, or it might be different. It might be just this.
Oh, totally.
This might be just opportunism as well. Who knows? Speaking of opportunism, Michele, let's take the opportunity to promote your business, Black Knight Solutions, hosting and domains, and. What have you got this week that you want to talk about?
Well, we're still doing promotions on kind of on bundles. I mean, basically what we're doing is with the .me one for $3.99 when you got a Minimus plan, and there's several other combinations you can get. So if you go over to domainoffers.me, you can see all our current offers. We offer discounts on hosting and domains, and if you buy hosting and a domain at the same time, you'll save yourself a lot of money.
You're a great salesman, Michele.
I'm not really. I'm terrible. I'm absolutely terrible.
You've got a nice patter going there now. I like it, I've got to say. Domainoffers.me and also blog.blackknight.com is a cool place to watch for the kind of promotions and ideas and things that you guys come up with there at Black Knight in Carlow and worldwide. Let's look at... I just skipped over this story. I nearly missed it, actually. It was we meant to talk about it before Black Knight, actually. It was in relation to... is it McAfee or McAfee? I look at it and I say McAfee, but people tend to say McAfee, don't they?
Well, Well, who cares what they say, really? I mean, it's...
You know, tomato, tomato.
Look, they're a very big, well-known security antivirus, blah, blah, blah company. Very, very well-known. We've all used their products at some stage. You know, it's a household name.
It's a household name, but it's also a man's name. And like a lot of these companies, they get started by somebody who then sells it on, and they keep the name, they keep the brand, they keep the trust that's involved in that. The person who originally founded the company and who has the name has continued to live a life, and it's a life that has perhaps a little bit of embarrassment now for McAfee the company.
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah. tell us about him, this man, John McAfee, or McAfee. What's he about, or what he's involved? He's a murder suspect.
Yeah, I mean, he's been living. It sounds like, I mean, the more that comes out about this story, the stranger it is. He sold the company several years ago, made a wad of cash, and instead of just going off and, you know, doing whatever it is that ultra rich people do, many cases that could be, you know, taking cruises around the world or maybe starting other businesses. This guy seems to have gone off and, well, done other things, let's just say. So he's on the run from the police. He's a murder suspect.
He's at large.
He's at large, but unlike other people at large, he started blogging.
So he's not exactly lying low. Started a blog, and is he trying to? What's the purpose of the blog? Is he trying to? Is he trying to clear his name? Is he trying to make his case? Is he trying to just give us a glimpse into the life of a fugitive?
Well, his first entry, with lots of time on my hands and very little to do with it, I've been reflecting on the recent detour my life has taken. That's one way of putting it. How did I end up as a murder suspect on the lam? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so I think it possibly what he's doing is he's trying to tell his story or something. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that's been kind of interesting is that the company, McAfee the company, has been trying to kind of distance themselves from him.
Really?
Well, that's kind of understandable. I mean, he hasn't been involved with the antivirus company since 1994.
Oh, well, fair enough then. Yeah.
I mean, he's long out of it. I mean, it's not a case of 6 months, a year or anything like that. I mean, 1994, that's 18 years. So he's well out of it. But, of course, his name is closely linked to them. It's just, it's bizarre. I mean, the entire thing is bizarre. And there's a photograph there, a Mashable of him, which isn't the worst photograph. I've seen other photographs floating around, and the guy looks a little bit, what can we say? He looks a little bit intriguing, let's just say.
Right, Michele, let's move on. The next two stories, actually, it's funny where you're Twittering and your web surfing leads you, but I actually found two tech stories on the News Talk, the radio station website, this week, which is having some kind of issues when you click on it. All kinds of error messages and login prompts come up. But leaving that aside, two interesting stories. The first of those, this was reported elsewhere as well. It's from last week. UK man wins case against employers over Facebook post. A man named Adrian Smith in England, who is someone with strong Christian beliefs, and that extends to an opposition to gay marriage, which is an opinion that he expressed on Facebook. And we've seen, as you said earlier, Michele, this is a case that we've seen cases like this that can go either way. And we've seen cases that have gone the opposite way to this. In this case, he, as a result of what he said and expressing his opposition to gay marriage on Facebook, his employers gave him a final written warning, and he lost his managerial position with the company and had his salary cut by 40% with his employers, Trafford Housing Trust. He took a case against them, sued his employers, and the case in the High Court in the UK, and has won his case against the employers, who the court ruled that essentially the employers exceeded their authority, I think, in relation to this. It's an interesting one, Michele. The employers say they had a code of conduct in regards to expressing religious or political views. But, and I'm not sure exactly what this was based on, the court judgment, But is it possible that this could have been construed as being a private conversation in the sense that it wasn't something which was published to the general public, but perhaps just expressed on Facebook?
But see, this is the thing that confuses me a little bit, is that, other cases have gone the exact opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, people have posted stuff on Facebook, on Twitter and elsewhere. And, okay, in the case of Twitter, a lot of that's going to be public. But in the case of Facebook, it isn't. I mean, it's only seen by your, you know, your connections, your friends in many cases. Mm. And yet people have lost their jobs.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess you could always argue that, you know, as to how public something is, and even if it is just restricted to your friends, it would be interesting to see perhaps some of his friends were some of his co-workers perhaps as well. I've read a recent story as well in relation to some other case where it was ruled, I think, at a court that that an employer was exceeding their authority by requesting that you hand over your password to look at what you were posting on Facebook as well. That doesn't seem to be an issue in relation to this. The only thing in this story is that the judge said the trust didn't have a right to demote Mr. Smith, as his Facebook postings did not amount to misconduct, and that they essentially, the employers, breached their contract in relation to this. This is going in different ways. What kind of policy as an employer, Michaela, what kind of a policy do you have? Do you have a strict policy in relation to social media use or what people say? Do you insist that people distinguish between, you know, the old disclaimer, all opinions my own, these are my thoughts and not those of my employer? Has that been an issue for you or something that you've felt has had to be addressed?
The short answer to that is, I mean, we have an internet usage policy, and we also have something within the employee handbook about, I can't remember the exact way it's worded, but I mean, the basic thing would be that within the employee handbook, if employees of the company are going around the place doing things or saying things that would bring the company into, I don't know what's the word, ill repute, or I don't, you know what I'm trying to say. Then that's obviously a problem. But beyond that, no, it doesn't go into specifics. So I mean, if one of my employees who was known to be an employee was to go on to various social media things and basically, I don't know, do something completely insane, then that probably would be a problem.
It's interesting in this case that it was an expression perhaps of a religious view. It could be argued that it was an expression of intolerance, and could be construed as intolerance or perhaps even hate speech, and that may have been part of the issue here. But on the other hand, you know, people are perhaps entitled to political opinions in that. So the employer in this case was, I think, a local authority or something. Trafford Housing Trust, I assume, is something like that, and may feel that they have to tread a fine line in relation to expression of political views. I don't know. The other story is interesting from News Talk as well. Michaela, I've a bit of a statistics fetish at times. This is a nice statistic. Internet to contribute 6 billion euros to the Irish economy. We were talking about this earlier in the year, I think, when we were there was the whole notion of copyright infringement and a SOPA, what was it, Irish Stop SOPA campaign, or the whole thing in relation to Minister Sherlock and all that early on in the year, and people got agitated and active online in relation to expressing the importance of the internet, and in particular highlighting you, and this was a case you were making, Michele, the importance, and it's not an importance that is diminishing or going away in any sense, the importance of the internet and online economy, and it's something that is going to grow, and we need to make sure that we have an environment which will allow that growth.
Yeah, and the problem is that to date, the Irish government still has not really engaged in internet policy. Yeah. It just hasn't. It's insane. You know, IPv6. How many Irish government websites are available over IPv6?
I think the answer is none, is it?
As far as last time I checked, yeah, that would be right.
Yeah.
You know, the there's the ITU are making all sorts of noises about taking over the internet, and I think it might be worth adding a link to the Google campaign that they started against that.
Oh, that's right. No, we didn't discuss that, or we haven't discussed this prior to the program. ITU, of course, the International Telecommunications Union. It's part of the UN, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean they're a very, you know, they're a big global organization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you know that's old, fine.
Older listeners may remember, I think its predecessor was CCITT or something like that. I think it was at one point.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh no, that's ITUT or something, which I think is part of ITUT.
The problem is that, you know, they've been making noises and they're having a meeting starting, I think it's next week or the week after, and it goes on for about 10 days or so. And they've been making all sorts of interesting noises about how they want to, you know, regulate the internet, which it would be very, very, very dangerous. And this is something that isn't going to go away, because if it's not the ITU, it's going to be somebody else.
Why would it be more dangerous than the way the internet is currently run, Michele? You know, is there not an argument to be made that putting things on some kind of an international footing would perhaps, you know, free it from interference?
The problem is, Con, that, you know, that some governments have very, very strange ideas about freedom. Well, I mean, it's not a matter of their strange ideas about freedom. They just don't really like the idea of freedom.
Yeah.
Google has put together an interesting page, which hopefully you'll be able to link to. I've just sent you the link to it.
Okay.
I mean, and it's, you know, it all comes down to the thing that, you know, some countries do not believe in a free and open internet. Mm-hmm. They don't. They want to filter and censor content. In the last 2 years, governments have enacted 19 new laws threatening online free expression. That's from the Google page, just to give you one silly little figure. I mean, even over here in Ireland, there's been noises recently about trying to block all adult content, forcing ISPs to block all adult content. So that would mean that if you as a consenting adult want to have a look at adult content, and again, adult content isn't very clearly defined. Mm-hmm. So even if you were looking, some content could be classified as being adult, in inverted commas, adult doesn't necessarily mean porn. And even if it does mean porn, if you're over 18, you're entitled to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I won't say there's a fine line, but maybe there is. And I mean, in some interpretations of it, adult could apply to what you might describe perhaps as, indeed, a good deal of art could be described as adult, in that it's not something that you would necessarily expose immature minds and eyes to.
But surely, Con, you're a parent. Surely it's up to you.
Exactly.
Make that choice for yourself.
Exactly, Michele. Exactly. You know, I mean, coming back to look at things from the Irish point of view like that, Michele, I think it's debatable, of course, but it could be often argued that we're not so concerned about principles and ideologies here in Ireland as we are about jobs and money and what's in it for us, you know, the gravy train or whatever it might be. So in some sense, you could argue that we might be safe enough if politicians can be convinced to at least look at these statistics, which in fact I think this is based on research by UPC, actually, who's behind it, called Ireland's Digital Future. They found some of these statistics, just to list some of them. 2.6 Irish people will spend 5.7 no, I'm not sure, 2.6 million, I presume, Irish people will spend 5.7 billion euros online in 2016, which, of course, is a significant year in terms of Irish centenaries and things like that. At the moment, it says the internet economy accounts for roughly 3% of Irish GDP, but by that 2016 year, it'll have doubled to 6% over the next 4 years, will contribute 11.3 billion annually to the Irish economy in 2016, rising from 4.7 billion from 2010 if current trends are maintained. It's very hard to argue with these kind of figures, and I'll put a link in to the article on News Talk as well in relation to that. But it is going to have to be taken seriously at a government level in this country, Michele, is it not?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, what successive Irish governments have done is they've gone up and they've made these wonderful speeches using lots of nice little buzzwords. Hmm. And they're great for the sound bites. But when it comes to them actually taking actual action as opposed to just talking about things, there's been very little, very, very little. And it does concern me because, you know, the attitude, the conversation I had with a civil servant a few months back in relation to Ireland's involvement in ICANN, IGF, and other intergovernmental fora where these things are discussed and where these things are decided, was, Ara, sure, look, you know, sure, whatever the Brits and the Americans do, it'll be grand.
Yeah, sure, that's all geeky stuff anyway. What was it that Deputy Buttermer said? Was it something in relation to, I can't remember, but there was it keyboard warriors, I think was the term that was the rather dismissive and derogatory, well, certainly dismissive term, I think, that was used.
Well, it's, you know, but this is the thing. Yeah. I think, you know, there's a generational problem there. I mean, the... Yeah. You know, you look at a lot of politicians and civil servants within both Ireland and the UK. I mean, the UK is probably way ahead of us in this regard. But, you know, you still have this problem with some of these ones where, you know, they're not really using the internet in the same way as the rest of us are. So I think in some cases they may not really be as sensitive to the realities as others. And, you know, we're going to end up being left behind if we're not careful.
Let's move on, Michele. There is an article on Wired that I'm going to link to. I don't know if we can discuss it in detail.
We can't really discuss it because it's a massive bloody article.
It is. And I have to say that we haven't read it, except that it's a story I've been watching since, I think, earlier in the summer. I think it was going back perhaps June or July,
I
think.
The upshot of it is, I mean, you've got another link there. What is it? To the 25 most...
It is, yeah. So just to explain before we go into that, just explain what it's about. The headline in Wired, and we may talk about this next week or at some other future occasion, "Kill the Password: Why a String of Characters Can't Protect Us Anymore." Now, that's certainly a kind of an idea that has been voiced by many people. I'll just say in relation to this article that it's written by a man named Matt Honan, who is the guy I talked about last July, who is a senior writer with Wired, and who found himself hacked to the extent that his identity was stolen. They got into his Gmail through social engineering. They, from there, got into absolutely everything else. And ultimately, it seems what they wanted, he explains in this article, they wanted his Twitter handle, which he's Matt, but he's Matt with one T. So he had a three-letter Twitter ID, which is apparently what they wanted to steal, which is something valuable. It makes me nervous, Michele, because I've got a four-letter Twitter ID, which I know is exponentially less valuable than a three-letter one, but at the same time, it is something that drew my attention to it. But the headline there, "Why a String of Characters Can't Protect Us Anymore," and this is an interesting idea. And but what's interesting then, of course, is I posted a link to the AVG blog there, Michele. Top 25 passwords of 2012 revealed. I'm sure you've seen this kind of list before.
Yeah, and the scary thing, Con, is it doesn't get any better. I mean, you could link to last year's report from another company, be it the one that you're linking to this time or another one, and you could probably go back, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years and find similar ones.
In fact, what they've done is they've done it like a, you know, like a chart or like a pop chart, in the sense that they've sort of said it's a top 25, and they've included in brackets after each entry what the position last year was. So number one password is password. And that is unchanged from last year, and I presume from previous years. The second most popular password, and again, this is unchanged, is 123456. So, I mean, this is a list of 25, which would, you know, I presume the list is longer, and I presume the hackers have, for a brute force attack, this is how you go about it, and in many cases can get surprising results.
Well, you don't need to limit yourself to those incredibly weak ones. I mean, the problem is that, I mean, this is one of those topics that, you know, you could talk about for hours. The problem in many cases, Con, is that, you know, people are using social media. They've got online banking. They've got their email. They've got online accounts with a whole load of different services. I was at an event not that long ago, and one of the people there I know updates a company's Twitter account and Facebook account from their mobile phone all the time. Yet they don't even put a simple password lock on their phone.
Oh, yes. Isn't that just waiting to happen?
And it's like, you're just kidding. Hold on a second. Are you mad? I mean, you know, somebody gets hold. I mean, there's certain apps that I will not install on my phone because I'm scared to death of what could happen.
If you lost the phone.
It will, yeah. I mean, if I lost the phone and somebody was able to get their hands on it, you know, unlocked. I mean, mine locks itself automatically after a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
And, you know, the problem is, I think there was another report, there's been several reports actually over the last few weeks about, you know, employees wanting to use their own devices, about people wanting to have their own mobiles, their own smartphones, and, you know, using this and, you know, how it increases productivity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But also, there is a risk. And, you know, the thing is, for a lot of organizations, they're not going to have the resources to be able to invest in these services to manage all the devices. You know, the services you can get that will allow you to remotely wipe all the phones in a company if you need to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're not as widespread or as accessible due to, you know, sheer cost and compatibility as people might like at the moment. There's a lot of risks out there, Colin. There really are.
There certainly are. I'm sure many of them were discussed today at the Iris Cert conference in Dublin. We've had Brian Honan on the programme before. This is the Irish Cert. How would you describe Iris Cert, Michele?
It's the Irish Cert. Yeah. I mean, basically, they're...
What's a Cert?
It's a voluntary organisation. Some of them are lined with governments, others aren't, and they are a security rapid response task force type organisation. So, you know, they will, you know, if you sign up for their emails and things like that, you'll get notifications about things that, you know, security issues. It's all part of the kind of cyber security space.
If you're working, I mean, if you're responsible for IT for a business or even for yourself individually, I mean, you really ought to sign up to these alerts. They come in by email and they can be pretty, you know, it's you'll be notified about what the latest vulnerabilities are. And it's very, very, especially yeah, I mean, if there's something that's actual, spreading at the moment or something like that. Yeah. There's an interesting one they've raised and a recent one which was sent out by them, Michele, that caught my attention was something I hadn't heard of before, which is ransomware. Had you heard about this?
Well, this kind of thing, I mean, what they're talking about there, it's a particular type of attack. Mm. But I mean, the kind of attack, there's been loads of attacks over the last few years where a group of hackers or whatever you want to call them will attack a prominent website, for example. Yeah. And, you know, the attack will involve sending, you know, multiple gigabits of traffic at the site.
Denial of service.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, this is denial of service on a massive scale. And the thing is, it's not like, say, with Anonymous or one of these other ones where they're doing it for philosophical reasons or whatever. These guys will do it, and it's purely monetary. So they'll say, right, you know, either pay us, you know, whatever the amount of money is, or we will knock you offline.
Yeah,
and
that's one element of it. This other one, which was outlined in a recent bulletin from Iris Cert as well, Michele, which really kind of I thought was particularly sinister. I think, you know, not that all of these aren't, but what they do is they get inside, they hack into your company, they disable your backups. Right. If you have some kind of scheduled backup running, they disable it, but they make it look as if it's still running. And then after a couple of weeks, when you've gone without backups, they then reveal the situation to you and take down your server and say, if you want your data back, only we have the keys and access, and you better pay money to us to actually get that. So it's and the obvious things. I mean, in relation to this and other things, the report goes on to talk about firewalls. and antivirus and things like that that you need to have in place to combat these kind of threats. But it is it's not going away, really, these kind of threats, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, they're, if anything, they're getting worse. And, you know, there is no simple solution. I mean, there is no kind of magical way that you can stop them. And the main thing, I suppose, is just to raise awareness. Because ultimately, you know, if you read, say, Kevin Mitnick's biography, which I read there a few weeks back, and, you know, he was talking about phreaking and stuff like, you know, hacking phone systems. And a lot of the stuff he was doing wasn't so much super duper IT skills or programming skills or anything like that. It was down to social engineering, you know, persuading somebody that you had access to something and that, you know, denying that person access would have caused a problem. I mean, it's fascinating and it's scary at the same time, you know.
It is, yeah. He must be considerably grown up now, Kevin Mitnick. I know he was a teenager on the run. He was a fugitive. He was the FBI's most wanted at one point or whatever. He's well into his 30s, I'd imagine, now, is he?
He's 49.
40, that old? Wow.
He wasn't a teenager when he was on the run at all.
Oh, wasn't he? No, I didn't realize that.
No.
All right.
No.
He's a good guy now, isn't he? White hat, he's on the...
Oh, totally, yeah, totally.
On the security side.
No, he's a fascinating character.
Go ahead, Michele.
If you go on and have a, you know, do a search for him, you'll find you know, there's an extensive information about him on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
You can also follow him on Twitter.
He was the first person I ever heard of who was, you know, the subject of a computer's ban. You know what I mean? Considered so dangerous that he wasn't allowed to use computers, I think, while he was in prison or something like that. That was part of the conditions, I think, of his detention or conditions of his sentence or whatever at the time. And in fact, I think what reminded me maybe and put the idea into my head was the person who hacked Matt Honan, and who ironically Matt ended up interviewing in the end, I think, and kind of covering even more. He's a teenage hacker who goes by the handle Cosmo the God, or something similar, I think, to that. I don't have any notes or reference here in front of me at the moment, but he's been sentenced recently as well, and he's been told to he can use computers, he can use the internet, but only under close supervision. So this kind of thing continues. A couple of stories that are on the light side, Michele, to round things off this evening. And this one I saw on Twitter this morning, and as you said, it's been seen elsewhere, reported elsewhere as well. The headline from ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reads, "Australian scientists undiscover a Pacific island."
Yeah, this is a bizarre. I mean, this is totally bizarre. Seemingly that Google Maps, Google Earth, and a bunch of other sources, not just Google,
including the maritime charts on the Geological Survey ship, which went out to look for this island and check it. I think they were suspicious because there's an island there, but the water in that area is 1,400 metres deep, and it didn't seem to make sense. I think that was one of the reasons why they decided to take a little joyride in their Geological Survey ship, and when they got to the place that their ship's chart, Google Maps, Google Earth, and indeed Yahoo Maps and other services as well, identify there being quite a considerably sized island. They discovered nothing.
Yeah.
Open water.
There is no island.
I mean, it must have been, was it an ink blot with maybe a 19th century cartographer? Was it a crumb from their buttered scone one morning? I just wonder,
It's bizarre. I mean, how on earth could you, like, you know, literally lose an island?
It even had a name.
Oh, totally. I mean, it wasn't a kind of a random...
In two languages. It's between Australia and French-governed New Caledonia. It was described as Sandy Island on Google Earth and Google Maps. And indeed, the French version of that, Sable is sand, isn't it, Michele?
Yeah.
Sable, or you might read it as Sable, S-A-B-L-E, Island, on the Times Atlas of the World currently identifies it as that. And there it is. There's on the ABC website at abc.net.au, you can see the island in an embedded Google map, but apparently it isn't there.
No, it's not. I mean, it's totally, totally bizarre. I mean...
Speaking of... go ahead.
No, I'm stunned. I mean, how on earth? I don't know. This just cracks me up.
This cracks me up, Michaela, the Ghostbusters picture. You said you'd seen it already. I saw one of the people I follow on Twitter is a man called Ronan Mishdale, and he tweeted that this evening, retweeted somebody else saying, this is why people have kids. And there's a picture of a toddler, but he's all dressed up like that giant ghost from, is that the first Ghostbusters movie or which, Michaela? You'd know more about this.
I actually can't remember.
Someone has recreated the scene now where there's this giant character with what is it again? It's
like he's in a sailor suit.
Yes, he's the kid in the sailor. Yeah, he's a giant character in a sailor suit with something puff. Is it puffed on the hat or something like that? Anyway, but all of the Ghostbusters characters are arranged around him like in little dolls and that. And there's a. You know, it's basically
Marshmallow Man. There you go.
That's what he's called, is it? Well, there you go. We'll put a link into it if people want to find it as well. Michaela, let's wrap it up for the night. Thanks indeed for talking to us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you then.